Working Class Audio is made possible by the support of Cali Audio, DistroKid, Sampley Audio, Audio Technica, Gearspace, and Grace Design.
This is the Working Class Audio Podcast, session 287.
Working Class Audio, navigating the world of recording with a working class perspective. Here is your host, Matt Boudreau.
Thanks, Chuck. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Working Class Audio Podcast. This is session 287 you're listening to. My guest today is Ignacio Molino, better known as Nacho Molino to many people. Nacho is a multi-Grammy-winning engineer who's originally from Panama and is a new transplant to the United States. And we have a great conversation about working in Panama, working in the U.S., his immigration to the U.S., and all other things surrounding that. So very excited to have him on. Nacho Molino coming up here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. All right, grab those coffee cups. What are we going to talk about? What are we going to talk about? Everybody's wondering. Let's talk about Michael Jordan. What? This is an audio podcast. Why are we going to talk about Michael Jordan? Get your coffee cup and I'll tell you why. I was talking to my friend, former WCA guest Kevin Ward the other day, and we were talking about Michael Jordan and the documentary that's out on him, and we were talking about his career and the shots he had taken, the millions of shots, well, not millions, but thousands of shots he missed, and the game-winning shots. And what came out of that was the fact that you just got to keep taking shots. I know it's a metaphor. You know where I'm going with this. But that's the thing, you know? Not everything you do is going to be award-winning or Grammy-winning or Tony Award-winning or, you know, whatever it is, or Oscar-winning, or I don't know what they give out for games or game sound. But anyways, I don't care what kind of audio discipline you're in. If you haven't had any successes that enable you to put trophies on your shelf, that's okay. Some of you don't even like the awards, and some of you do. And if that's important to you, my recommendation to you is you just got to keep taking shots, just like Michael Jordan. You've got to keep working and working and working and working. If you're not failing, you're not trying. I know we have to put this into perspective. Working on a record that doesn't get any recognition necessarily in the national spotlight is not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, how many bands have you all worked with, or games that, or films that just don't really see the light of day because of various circumstances? I can tell you, I've worked on tons of records that nobody knows about, nobody cares about. I've been fortunate to, in my time working at KFOG in San Francisco as a freelance guy, I've gotten to record and mix some, you know, great artists and bands that I really admire that all of you know about, but I've never been able to work on a record that has stood the test of time that all of you would know about. And I have mixed feelings about that, but at the same time, I still love audio. I still love working. And even if it never happens, I will keep doing it. I will keep doing audio because it's meaningful to me. And I'm sure a lot of you feel that way. Now, along the way, if something happens and I get some success, great. But if I don't, that's great too. That's fine. So back to the metaphor. You just got to keep taking shots. If it's important to you, one way or the other, you're just going to have to keep taking those shots. And eventually, you're going to sink the ball in, so to speak, and everybody's going to cheer, and you'll have your moment in the sun and your trophy. And that's fine. But if that never happens to you, it's not the end of the world, and it doesn't mean your career is any less meaningful. So take it with a grain of salt. If it's important, keep going. If it's not important, keep going. Either way, just keep going. Keep taking those shots, because you never know what's going to happen. That's it. Basketball. Yeah. Bet you never thought I'd be talking about basketball on this show. Thanks for listening. Most of you already know about Grace Design and have known about them for years. They've been around since 1994. It was started by the two brothers, Michael and Eben Grace, who still run the company to this day. And you already know that they make incredible sounding products for us all. What you might not know, if you don't know them, is that Michael and Eben are two of the nicest people on the planet. Easily approachable, very knowledgeable. You might have met them at a trade show and experienced this. Without a doubt, it's one of my favorite companies out there in the world of pro audio. You might have heard me a few times talking about the Grace 908 Atmos controller. I think the most elegant solution, if you're going to be doing Atmos, that is the best solution out there, as far as I'm concerned, hands down. And prior to that, I was using the Stereo 905 controller for many years. Not only that, but most recently, I have used their 108 mic pres to do the Room 219 combo jazz record that you might have heard me talk about. The point is that they check all the boxes for me. They're incredibly nice people. They make incredibly great products. They're located here in the United States in Lyons, Colorado, and employ a number of people. They're the epitome of a small business here in the US, and I just love that whole thing. So if you are in the market for mic preamps or instrument preamps or monitor controllers, this is the company to check out, hands down. If you don't know about them, go to gracedesign.com, check them out. And if you're in the market for any of those products, you absolutely have to consider what they offer, because what they offer is superior build quality and sound quality. And those of you who bought their products in the 90s that are still using them, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So check them out, gracedesign.com. I know the business of audio is a frustrating one sometimes. The audio part's pretty fun, but it's the business of it and the career part of it that's a little challenging to many of us. I can completely empathize with that. And if you thought to yourself, God, I wish I could talk to somebody about this, you can do that. You could talk with me about it. As a matter of fact, you can book me for a coaching and consulting call over Zoom very simply. Just head on over to workingclassaudio.com. If you click on the menu button at the top of the menu, there is a link that says coaching and consulting with Matt. Super simple. Click on the link, book me in for an hour on a Zoom call, and we will discuss your particular situation, and I will help you get refocused, re-inspired, and figure out what is the best path forward for you. If your situation requires a little more extensive conversation, we can absolutely book a series of calls. And like I say, get you focused and get you moving forward. I've been there, and when you don't have anybody to talk to about it, it's a little frustrating. So head on over to workingclassaudio.com, click on the menu button, and book yourself in for a Zoom call with me. And we could sit down and chat, coffee's in hand, ready to tackle the business of audio together. That's it. Let's get to it. Nacho Molino, here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Nacho, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm good, man. I think I'm on my third coffee now, so I'm ready to fold paper bags.
Oh, I'm on my second one right now.
Oh, you'll get there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you're talking to me from Rochester.
Yes, very close to Rochester. Actually, it's called Fairport. It's about 20 minutes away from Rochester.
Okay. And did you grow up there?
No, I grew up in Panama, in Central America.
Uh-huh.
And I moved to the States last year, actually.
We'll get into that. I definitely want to talk to you about Panama, but let's start with right now, with the present time. What are you doing? What is your world centered around day to day?
Well, right now, I'm mostly doing mixing, but I also do some production and recording if somebody needs it. So right now I'm here in Rochester recording a whole album and producing it too with a rock band. It's coming out pretty nice.
And is mixing your primary activity?
Yeah, it's become my primary activity since a lot of people are recording at home or they have their own home studios, which are basically called home studios because they are at their home, but they're actually very pro equipped. So that's how it goes nowadays.
And the place that you mix at where you're at now, is that your home? Is it a building you rent, a building you own? What's that status?
Well, right now, my mixing room is in Brooklyn, New York. I rent that room from a mastering engineer that works right next door to me. And I've been there for a year now. And it's a very, very nice room. It's very well conditioned and everything. So mixes are coming out so incredible.
And the amount of work you have coming in justifies that rent. I know that sounds like a silly question, but I have to ask.
Yeah, well, you know how this is. Sometimes you have a lot of work and sometimes you have less work. So you always have to, you know, save up for the slow times. But yes, I managed to keep my head out of the water.
That's good to hear. Tell me about growing up in Panama.
Well, Panama is a very small country. Right now, I think we are up to 4 million people there, population-wise.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot of American influence since we had the American bases there all the way up to the year 2000, which was when all the military, the U.S. military left, and the Panama Canal became actually part of Panama itself, because before it was administrated by the U.S. It's like a huge town. Like, everybody knows everybody. So it's very easygoing in a certain way. Because, for example, to get work as a recording engineer or a mixing engineer, you already know everybody. So you only have to say that you're doing it and actually be good at it, and you'll get clients right there. It's not very difficult to market yourself in it.
And music scene-wise, what's that like?
Well, since the population is very small, you have the traditional genre-based scenes, like you have metal or you have rock or you have salsa or whatever. But there are very small scenes. So as a recording engineer or producer or mixer, you have to be good at everything people throw at you. If not, you're going to die out of hunger, you know?
So you can't really specialize. You can't hyper-focus on one task. You got to be able to do a bunch of different things.
Yes, and you have to do them all the right way, or people will go somebody else.
How old were you in 1989?
1989, I was 8 years old.
You were eight. Do you have any memory of the Noriega years and the U.S. coming to get Noriega?
Yeah, I remember that. It was pretty scary, to tell you the truth. I remember I used to sleep on a bunk bed, and I used to sleep on the top bed. My brother would sleep on the bottom one. And every night I would get my parents telling me to just sleep on the floor because they didn't want any missing bullets coming through the window or anything.
Wow.
So that was very scary, scary times.
Why were bullets going to be coming through the walls?
Well, basically, it kind of became like a civil war in a sense. Because you had the people that were actually supporting Noriega, and you had the people that were against Noriega. So stuff would get pretty messed up at some point. And then the U.S. came in, and in the end, they took Noriega and everything, but there was a point where it was very, very dangerous. I remember, like, that Christmas night, all the men from the building would do shifts to guard the building door at night with guns.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very messed up.
Yeah, that must have been a tense time for you as a kid.
Yeah. You know, like, going through Christmas and not getting like any presents or anything because all the stores were closed or being looted or whatever.
Yeah. Wow. I can't even imagine. I can't fathom that at all. And so that's why I had to ask. I hope you're not offended by my question.
Not at all, man.
Well, so at what point in your life did audio present itself to, number one, catch your interest? And when did it get you to think, I could do this for a living?
Okay. As usual, I had a band. And we went into our first recording session, which was done by the drummer's that he bought an 8-at. I remember it. We only had like 8 tracks to record the whole band. It was a punk band. And I really liked the mixer and the microphone placement and all this stuff. So I that really, really made me go like, oh man, this is so cool. And after that, I got a 4-track, a little Yamaha cassette 4-track, and started recording stuff in my room. I would basically get like whatever microphone I could get a hold of and just put it in front of my guitar amplifier. And I would do the drums on my dad's keyboard with those very fake sounding drums. And it all started there, basically. So yeah, when I graduated school, I already knew that I was going to go that way.
And what did you study when you say graduated from school? Are you talking about college? Are you talking about high school or?
High school.
High school. Okay. And did you do any schooling for audio?
Yes, I did, quote unquote, go to college because it was actually a distance program. Mm-hmm. Because in Panama, we didn't have at the moment any colleges or universities teaching recording engineering. So I actually took mine from Chile. At that time, people were starting to do this distance courses through the emails and everything. So I sent the money and I just hoped that I wasn't going to get ripped off.
How much money are we talking about?
It wasn't that much. Just probably $600 for this first part. And then like $1,000 for the second part or something like that.
Okay.
Which is doesn't seem like a lot of money, but for in Panama, we do use the dollar as a currency.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, like minimum wage is very, very low. So talking about, let's say, $500, it's more than what a person would do in a whole month at that time.
Got it. Did you know the current president, Laurentino Cortizo?
Yeah.
He makes $7,000 a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in Panama, that's a crap ton of money.
Yeah. Basically, with $7,000, you can be the king of the hill.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what you need to survive at a core level at San Francisco.
Yeah. Also in Brooklyn.
Yeah. In a studio apartment.
Yes.
Eating ramen. When did you decide to come to the U.S.? What made you decide to come to the U.S.?
Well, I always wanted to come to the U.S. because of the music market here.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, my mother, she's a U.S. citizen. So I got all the paperwork done. But when she put the papers in, I was already over 21. It took about 15 years for the papers to get approved.
Okay, let me wrap my head around that. So your mom, who's a U.S. citizen, put in the paperwork for you, her son, to become a U.S. citizen. At the time, you were over 21, and it took 15 years?
Yes.
I don't even know what to say about that. That's not only absurd, but just, oh, wow. So what did you do in that 15 years, in that waiting time?
I basically worked my ass off. I got a job at a live sound company, and then I started working in studios, and then I finally opened mine. All the time, just working in audio and trying to survive, learning every single thing that I could about every music genre, actually.
Uh-huh.
Just waiting for that to come up. And then in 15 years, there are so many things that happen. Like, I got married, I had my first son, and then after 5 years, I got divorced. And 3 years later, I got married again. All of those things, since your marital status changes, it also changes the paperwork. So when you get married, then you're not single anymore. You're married. And when you get divorced, then you're divorced, but you have a kid. And then when you get married, then you're married again. So it all just makes it take longer. It was supposed to take around 10 years, but actually took 15.
And because the marriage, divorce activity contributed to that delay. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Still 10 years. Come on.
Yeah. 10 years is a lot. If my mom had been able to submit my papers before I was 21, it supposedly takes around 6 months only to get everything done.
Oh.
But when you're over 21, then I don't know why, it just takes about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like running a studio in Panama? And what city are we talking about?
It's Panama City.
Okay.
Yeah, the capital. Yeah. So it's very stressing, to tell you the truth. Because like I was telling you, the music scene is so small. And, you know, nowadays with all the digital recording, everyone wants to record and everyone wants to be a producer and an engineer. So everybody has something in their house and they're offering services for very little money and they're recording from home. I mean, if that works for them money-wise, it's all good. But if you have to actually maintain a whole infrastructure, meaning control room, recording room, air conditioning, all the gear and everything, it makes it very complicated to just make the amount of money needed to actually make it work. But the interesting thing is learning how to work with several music styles, because one day you're doing salsa, next day you're doing metal, and the next day you're doing jazz, and the next day you're doing cumbia, and the next day you're doing reggae, and then you go back to salsa. Every day is a different story. So it really doesn't get boring at all in that sense.
Are there any problems with government bureaucracy getting in the way or anything like that?
No, not really. Besides paying your taxes, which you have to do in any country in the world, and keeping like all the operation permits up to date and all the regular stuff that you would have to do in any country. But one thing is that the electricity in Panama is very expensive. For example, in one of the studios that I had, which was the biggest one I had, the air conditioner wasn't running all day long or anything. It was probably running like 8 to 10 hours a day. And I had to pay a whole bunch of money, like, I don't know, like $500 a month or something. And I was only running my Pro Tools rig. It's not like I had an SSL or anything running.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do people do solar for businesses out there?
Well, people are starting to do so. In the beginning, it was a little bit confusing because there were laws that were kind of like against it, but then they modified them. So people are starting to use solar now.
And for the listener, Panama, just in your head, so south of Panama is Colombia, north is like Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras. So would you have influx of recording artists from all of Central America coming in?
Well, not recording, but mixing.
Ah.
Yeah, people would send their stuff on WeTransfer or Dropbox or any of those services. And yes, you'd be mixing stuff from all over Central America. And yeah, also one good thing is that since those countries are not too far away, if you have a band, you can always just go tour to all those other countries and then make like a partnership with another band. And for example, they take you to Costa Rica and you play a couple of shows there, and then you take them to Panama and they play a couple of shows there because, I mean, it's only an hour flight.
Oh, yeah, Panama City in relation to San Jose, Costa Rica, that looks like a hell of a drive. So, yeah, an hour flight sounds great.
Yeah, I went to San Jose, Costa Rica in a bus several times, and it's like about 16 hours or so.
That's just too much. I think that all the driving in a van, touring in my 20s just burned me out on that.
Yeah, I understand it.
Okay, so you come to the U.S. Now, what's that like when you get notified that, hey, it's time. Your 15-year paperwork cycle is complete. Come on in.
I mean, it was very exciting. I was very happy that I could finally come. At the time, I had a business partner that, you know how things happen in life, that everything gets aligned for everything to happen?
Yeah.
My ex-business partner is not from Panama. He's from Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still very close friends. So at that time, he was actually thinking about going back to Argentina because his parents were getting older and everything. So he was actually thinking about leaving Panama. And then I get my papers done. And then that was like, okay, let's just go our separate ways and just close the business there. And my wife, she's from Colombia, and she didn't know how to speak English at all. So that has been a very fun thing, teaching her how to speak English so that she can have her own life. Well, when we got here, it was February, and we went to my mom's house in Salem, Massachusetts. So it was snowing like crazy. And Panama is a very hot country.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't really snow in Panama.
No, it's always like 95 to 100 or something like that, like all year long. And it's very humid. So then you get here and it's like snowing. And it's like, I don't know, like 20 something degrees or so.
God, I hate snow.
I really enjoyed it. My daughter, she's 4 years old, and she was out on the snow, like making snowballs and throwing them and having so much fun. So it was pretty nice in that sense.
Yeah, just tell her it's all fun and games until you have to drive through it.
Oh, yeah, or that you have to shovel the snow to get the car out of the garage.
Oh, yeah. There's some great places in this world to live that are just off my list because of snow.
Yeah, I can bet.
How did you find out that you were accepted to come into the country?
You know, all these things have to be done through a lawyer. So basically, our lawyer, she kept us up to date every now and then. And when the papers finally got approved, then you have to go to the U.S. Embassy for an interview to actually get the final approval. And so, yeah, we were like nervous as hell, as you can imagine, because it's not the same as a tourist visa where you go there and you just show that you have a job in Panama and that you are not going to stay in the U.S. doing nothing. But you're basically coming to the U.S. to make a living. So they background check you all the time and they do all this research and whatever. And then you go to the interview and they ask you a whole bunch of things and whatever, but it all came out good. And we got our papers approved. And then we had to wait, like, I think like for a month or so to get the seal on the passport, which is basically like a temporary green card. And then you come here to the US and then you go through migration. All those little steps are very nerve-wracking because at any point they can just send you back. It doesn't matter if you are approved, the immigration officer could you just say like, okay, no, you cannot go in, so you go back or whatever. So when we finally got here, it was like, yay, let's party, because it was such a long, long, long wait.
Well, so now do you have official citizenship?
I have a legal residency and also I can work. So it's not a citizenship, but it's a residency with work permit. And then I have to wait for, I think, 5 years or so, so that then I can apply for the citizenship.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bjorg van Benedictsen from Audio Issues, who's been a guest of mine and who's a friend of mine, he came from Iceland and I think he went through a similar process of waiting and eventually applying for citizenship. Interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and how long has it been again? Tell me.
Yeah, it's about a year and a half.
About a year and a half, huh?
Yes.
Well, what do you think so far?
Well, so far, I'm loving it. I've met so many new people, so many great people that have been very welcoming. I mean, I know for you right now, like what the country is going through is very unusual.
Oh, yeah, to say the least.
Yeah. But in Panama, that would be just complete normal. So like everything that's happening right now is basically the day-to-day in Panama. Like it's completely standard for me. I mean, I should pay more attention to it, but I haven't because it's basically, you know, normal. And I know it's at some point it will go away and it will all come back to being like the normal US that it was before. So, yeah, I mean, it's been really great because, like I told you, I've met so many people and I've met so many engineers that I admire a lot. For example, right now I'm in your podcast, which I listen to all the time, and I've literally heard like every single episode of it. So
you must be really tired of listening to my voice.
Oh, no, man. Like every single episode has its own thing and you always get something out of it. It's very interesting.
Well, thank you. That's great. I'm glad you feel that way.
Hey, our friends over at DistroKid have created the DistroKid app for Android, which allows you to do some key things such as check your stats from Apple and Spotify, edit release metadata, upload new releases, and a host of other features. And remember, WCA listeners get 30% off your first year at DistroKid. And if you just head on over to workingclassaudio.com/WCA30, you can follow the link, get your 30% off, and be off to the races. So check our friends out at DistroKid and make sure and get your 30% off by going to workingclassaudio.com/WCA30. About a year and a half ago, I signed up for Samply.app, and I have to report back and say that I'm completely thrilled with it and it's working out quite well. It gives me the ability to upload mixes and masters to the website and provide a super pro looking interface for my clients. They can drop comments in the timeline. They can listen on any device. They can listen to it in high res. And if I want them to pay for the mix or master before they download it, because of the Stripe integration, I can set that up. There's also Dropbox integration, which allows me to quickly create a folder in my Dropbox, which automatically syncs with Samply, makes it much more simple. You should check it out for yourself, but there's a deal to be had. So use the code WCA20. Go to Samply.app or Samply.app. Use the code WCA20, get 20% off, and you'll be off to the races. It's a fantastic tool that I think you're going to enjoy and will definitely make you look a lot more pro when you're delivering files to clients. Skip that whole business where you send it to them over Dropbox. That looks totally amateur at this point. Use Samply.app and use that code WCA20, and I think you're going to be really thrilled. Samply.app. Check it out.
Well, so you've got some Grammys under your belt.
Yeah.
And those happened prior to you coming here.
Right.
Did that have any impact on your getting in here?
No. According to the lawyer, that doesn't matter.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe if I was asking for a work visa or an artist visa, then it would have an impact. But for a residence, it doesn't matter.
Okay. I had a previous guest on and it coming from Australia to here, and her Grammy sealed the deal, I think, for the immigration person at the time.
Wow.
you've been here and you're enjoying it. Now, what was your planning like? What was your decision-making process like to get yourself established, get a place to mix in? And had you been planning this for some time?
Well, not really, because I didn't know when the papers were going to come up. For example, the mastering engineer that I rent the place from, we've been working for a long time, for about like 8 years or so. So when I got my papers, I told him like, hey, man, I got my papers approved and everything. And at the same time, he was moving out from his old studio to a newer and bigger place. And he had a spare room. So he offered it to me. And I said yes. And then I asked how much.
Have you found anything difficult along the way in getting settled?
Well, I guess it would be the same if I went to any other country, that you have to adapt to how things are done in certain places, what the common rules are and whatever. But it hasn't been that hard because Panama has a lot of American influence. So I have had to change a couple of things, but not too much. And just get used to, like, for example, driving here is like very strict in Panama. Driving, dude, you would go crazy. You have to have like 5 eyes on each side of your head so that you don't get into a car crash.
That's funny.
Yeah, here, everyone makes a stop. Everyone puts their directional lights on when they're on the highway or whatever. In Panama, it's like you have to have a crystal ball to know what the guy in front of you is going to make.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there. I don't feel like everybody's using their turning indicators as they should be, at least where I live. And that's probably, if you ever find yourself in a car with me and I burst out in a tirade of F words, that's probably because the person in front of me is not putting their turning indicator on.
Well, I'm pretty sure there are always exceptions, but like, the majority of people do, at least.
Yeah, compared to Panama.
Over there in Panama, you cannot actually use your turning lights, because if you're going to change from a lane and you use that turning light, the guy that's coming behind you, he'll take your space. So you just change lanes and that's it.
Got to keep them guessing.
Yeah.
Now that you're here and you've got a place to work and getting established, figuring out the lay of the land, what are you doing to promote yourself, to find work, to continue in the adventure that is audio?
Well, first of all, I've been trying to network, probably not as much as I should, but I've been trying to network with bands and artists and whatever. I luckily have my usual clients from before moving in, so I've been getting work from them. Even when this whole virus thing came up, I thought everything was going to go downhill. And fortunately, it hasn't. I've kept myself busy enough. Yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of getting onto the social networks and just talking to people and posting stuff whenever something gets released and whatever. And hopefully someone who likes your work will message you or something.
Yeah, or find you on LinkedIn like I did.
Yeah.
Obviously, you didn't expect the coronavirus to be a part of your plan. So let's just look ahead in the future. Let's think vaccine. And let's say that we've got this under control and things open up 100% and everybody's out and about. Will you continue to focus on mixing, or will you try to get more recording work?
Well, whatever comes into the table. I enjoy recording and I enjoy producing as long as I know that I can actually deliver something good for the artist, as we all do. I do like mixing more than anything, but if I really like the music that I'm working on, I really enjoy producing and recording. So I really wouldn't care if I get recording work or mixing work. It's all good.
And the fact that you speak English and Spanish really gives you a leg up in terms of communicating and expanding your reach in terms of clients, I would assume.
Yeah, because then I'm not only limited to a certain region or anything. I can just talk to anybody, basically.
And possibly expand getting clients from Mexico, for example. Not like,
oh, yeah.
Not like people don't speak Spanish here, but that's a pretty big country and there's a lot of music happening.
Yeah, I just finished mixing a song for 2 twins that they're doing reggaeton music and they just released it and like the song is doing very well and everything. So yeah, I'm getting clients from basically everywhere And it's funny because once people see that you are in one of these music mecca cities, like New York or Los Angeles or Nashville, let's say, people from Latin America think that you are this kind of superhero or very pro guy that they can send their music to mix or to be mastered or whatever. So it's basically, it helps a little bit in terms of a marketing strategy.
How do you structure what you charge, and do you change what you charge based on the region?
Well, certain countries use different currencies, like for example, Argentina. So it's very, very difficult for them to actually pay a lot of money in dollars. So if you want to work with somebody from Argentina, you have to be careful of how much you're going to charge, because probably it's not that they don't want to pay it. It's just that they cannot afford it, which is two different things. Same in any other country that doesn't use the dollar. You have to be very careful with the rates. But lately, I've been getting those rates closer and closer and closer to just one steady rate for everybody.
That's a balancing act like none other. So how do you focus in on what the right rate to charge is for any particular country?
Well, it's something that you kind of learn or start knowing about with years of experience. For example, my ex-business partner, he's from Argentina. So he would tell me like, okay, we have to charge this much because then they're not going to take the project or whatever. So figuring out Argentina was easier. Mexico, the rates there are very cheap, but for some reason, they don't have much issues paying like a regular rate for real, because I think they send a lot of stuff to be mixed and mastered outside of Mexico. So they're kind of like used to that. But for example, Costa Rica and Colombia, most of the time you have to be careful that you're not overcharging, because it's not like you're overcharging, but you're overcharging to their angle, to their point of view, you know?
Right. For that market, for that economy, for that ecosystem.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is like, it doesn't matter how much I charge, I always have to deliver a good product. So it's very difficult because you cannot say like, okay, if I mix a certain amount of songs a month, I'm going to be fine. It's never the same math every day.
I guess you can't really advertise a rate when you're dealing with a multitude of countries like that.
No, because then some people would think like you're ripping them off, and other people would think like you're charging too little and they wouldn't take you seriously. So it's, you got to basically keep it to yourself and in between your clients.
Okay. And I guess there's no one single rate that works. You just got to look at the client, look at the country, look at the currency, and make an assessment from there.
Right.
Okay. When you got the Grammys that you did your work change in terms of the amount of work that you got? Because you can say, I'm a Grammy winning engineer. Does the word Grammy in your eyes bring work?
It opens doors for stuff to happen. It makes it easier for you to probably negotiate a project. Or if you come up with an idea, then people will open the door for you to have a meeting easier than if you don't have a Grammy. But you still have to put the work in to get more work. It's not like the magic wand that you get a Grammy and then you get a whole bunch of people lined up for mixing or recording.
Are you actively involved in seeing that, like, you work on a record, there's a lot of different things that have to happen after a record is completed in order for it to be even heard by a Grammy committee. So are you actively involved in what happens to that record afterwards to see it through, to make sure that it's heard, potentially nominated, et cetera? Or do you just do your work and cross your fingers?
Every time I work on a record that I think it's worth submitting, I make sure that either the artist submits the record or I'll submit it myself. Depending if they are a member of the Academy or not, then if they are a member, they'll submit it by themselves. And if not, then I'll submit it.
And what about now? Now that you're in the US, will you involve yourself in the Academy here?
Yes. I started just before the coronavirus thing started, because for the National Recording Academy, you need 2 recommendations. And then, well, the mastering engineer that works right next door to me gave me his, and I was going to ask somebody else. And then the whole thing blew up and I didn't ask anybody else.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would like to get involved.
I've talked to a range of people who have varying opinions about the Recording Academy in general. And obviously it's a part of your world. It's worked out well for you. Like, I have some friends that have some very different views than those who participate in the Grammy process. So I'm curious about how you feel about it in general.
I wouldn't know what to say, in the sense that I don't know if, for example, like people say like somebody's cheating or somebody's paying someone or whatever. I really don't know. And I couldn't point my finger to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically don't know. I mean, there are things that happen, but how can you prove that something is happening?
Right, right.
So it's basically like, yeah, just let it be, because then you're going to start a conversation basically based in nothing, because you cannot, you don't have evidence of anything wrong happening below the table, you know?
Yeah. And I know people that not only those concepts of favoritism and cheating and payoffs, et cetera, but also just the concept of album of the year or recording of the year or whatever, whatever the award would be. I have friends that would, they're just not into that whole thing applying to something so subjective as music. So I hear both sides all the time.
Yeah, but for example, I'm a voting member for the Latin Academy. So when it's time to vote, you have so many options to vote for. So the right thing would be to actually sit down and listen to all the options, right? At least one song, at least. And I know many people don't, and they have a friend that is probably going to get nominated if they get enough votes or whatever. I know that happens. It happens everywhere on every voting system, right? It's human nature, basically. The right thing would be just to listen to the whole thing if you can, and then submit your votes based on something that's valid. The other thing is that some people say that popularity doesn't count in the Grammys, which could be true if people did their homework of listening to everything, which is basically very difficult to do. For example, if, let's say, Adele gets submitted, how many people know Adele, right? So that name is just going to grab your attention right there. So you're going to go listen to Adele. But then if you see, I don't know, John Doe, whatever, and you're like, oh, I've never heard this one. So your homework is to listen to the new Adele and to listen to the new John Doe, and then make a decision based on reality. But I know some people just don't have the time or whatever, and they want to submit their vote, which is very irresponsible in my opinion. But I know there are people that just do that, or that they vote for their friends, or all these sort of practices that are not correct.
It's just like the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's the same. It's just, it happens on every voting system.
Yeah, you're right. Because basically, if it, like, just to go down that rabbit hole for a bit, there are people in the U.S. government and Congress that don't read bills when they come up. They vote for their friends because, you know, oh, vote for me because I've got, this is my bill. Oh, yeah, I'll vote for it. But they never read it. So it's out of laziness and just accepting that that's what it's going to be. And it's the same thing maybe in the world of the Recording Academy. Is it?
Yeah, because I mean, it's not the Academy that's who's the one to blame for, you know?
It's the members.
Yeah, it's the members. Because members vote and the Academy respects the vote and they put out the winner according to the votes. So
yeah,
again, if people start talking and talking and talking, they mostly don't have any proper evidence or base to say something. Because even me right now saying what I'm saying, it's something that I've seen people do, but I don't have evidence of it. So it's not like I can just point my finger at anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't blame either the Academy or the president or anyone in the administrative part or anything. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah. I think the lesson here is if you're going to be in the academy, be a responsible academy member and do the right thing.
And vote responsibly. The same as if you're going to vote for a president, you got to know who you're voting for.
Exactly. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole.
Our friends over at Cali Audio have just introduced the brand new LP-UNF system, which is meant to give you everything you need from a studio monitor in a package that you can basically set up anywhere. And the system is specifically designed for your desk, so no matter how else you're using your desk, reflections from the drivers to the desk to your ears are accounted for, giving you a perfectly clear picture of your mix that you can rely on to translate well. Whether you're putting them on stands behind your desk, on a desk away from walls, on a desk against a wall, on a desk on speaker stands away from the walls, there's a number of configurations, and they have settings on the back to accommodate all of that and more. And if price is a concern, never fear. They're priced at $299. That's right, pretty affordable. Head on over to CaliAudio.com and check out the new LP-UNF.
Very interesting. So what about business and money and the art of recording? What have you learned? How do you handle yourself? What recommendations do you have to others when we're talking about money and business in the world of recording?
Music is the easiest way to rip somebody off. It's the easiest. So just make sure that you either charge a deposit or you get paid up front. Or something, because a lot of people just go like, okay, I'll give you the, for example, a 50% deposit. And when they're finished recording, they don't have the other 50%. And there's no contract for that. Like, the music business is very informal sometimes, because you're either recording your friend or somebody that you know from the music scene or whatever. And you don't want to make a situation stressful just because of money, and then so you don't pay enough attention to that part, and then you don't get paid. And even though if you keep the project to yourself and not give the project to the client that hasn't paid you, you're not gaining anything by it. You already put your work in, and your bills are going to come at the end of a month. Even if you keep their project there, they haven't paid you. So just make sure you either have a contract or that you get paid up front. It doesn't matter who it is. I mean, if it's a true friend, they'll sign the contract because they're your friends and they don't want to rip you off. If somebody doesn't want to sign a contract, then that's a clear red flag right there. And then you should probably not be doing any work with them.
Yeah, which can be tough sometimes because we see an artist with promise and we like the music, and sometimes that can cloud our judgment about the business side of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's always good to get the business side of it out of the way as fast as you can, in the sense that just talk about it, agree on whatever you have to agree, and then just get a contract or, I don't know, some sort of evidence that the person has to pay you or something, and then get that out of the way and start thinking about the music. But also, I mean, for example, there are some times where, like, I listen to a band that I like, and then I go like, hey, what have you guys been doing? And are you recording any new material or whatever? I think it could be of some help for you or whatever. And then I will mix a song for them for free without any strings attached. And if they like it, they'll probably send me the next song to mix, but it would be a paid mix, not a free one.
Do you find it easier to do audio business when you're just mixing as opposed to recording or producing? It seems to me it would be more simplistic, and it's just a simple, I'm going to do this, therefore you pay me, and that's that.
The thing with mixing is that unless you ask for a pre-mix up front, you don't know what you're getting into.
What do you mean by that, a pre-mix up front? You mean like a rough mix?
Yeah, like a rough mix, yeah.
Okay.
Some people write to me either on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and they haven't yet recorded the song, and they're asking for rates and whatever. So at that point, you don't know what you're getting into, because they can be recording at home, and they can be phenomenal recordings. Or they could be recording at a really pro studio and have a crappy recording too. So it's a little bit tricky when it comes about mixing. And also, when people ask you for a mixing job, it's probably because they're not happy with what another engineer did for them. And that's mostly been my experience. Like, not many people think about going to this studio to record and then send this off to mixing to, let's say, Crystal or Algae or something like that. Like, it usually happens in the industry. If someone's independent, they'll probably got a quote from the studio that already includes mixing and mastering for that whole project, right? And sometimes they're not happy with the mix, and then they go out and search for somebody to make a better mix. But anyways, was it recorded properly or wasn't it?
When you mix and you're mixing from unknown sources, you're kind of trying to navigate through all of this that we're talking about. Let's say that you finally get a client who's got the tracks are decent, or even if they're not decent, they're at least fixable. What are the other challenges you deal with when mixing remotely for people?
A huge challenge would be that a track is not salvageable. And then you have to find a way to tell the client that they should re-record something. And sometimes they don't take it the right way. We as musicians are very easy to get hurt emotionally. So I think it's a matter of explaining to them, like, okay, it's not your fault. It wasn't that you didn't play the guitar good enough, but probably the microphone wasn't placed correctly. So I can't get rid of this mosquito sound that it has, stuff like that. So you have to find the way of telling them. And then they're probably out of a budget, so they cannot re-record it either. So it sometimes gets to a dead end, and then you have to just deal with what you have and try to make the best out of it.
Something that is starting to creep up more and more on me that I'm having to address is clients who are failing to listen on a proper setup.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you send the mix, and then, like, the notes come back within, like, 2 hours. And you're like, well, first of all, that was awful quick. And second, these notes are completely at odds with everything I'm hearing. And digging a little deeper, I'm finding out, oh, you only listened to it on your laptop and that was it? And you didn't take it around to the car stereo or a bigger stereo or some headphones? And that's something that I'm having to address currently. And I'm being proactive in asking people, what are you listening on? How are you listening?
Yeah, well, I get the same. For example, once I got like a revision note that said they couldn't hear the backing vocals, which were completely panned out to left and right. But the guy was listening on the cell phone speaker, which sums up to mono. So those sides just get lost. And then it's like, how can you not listen to them? I can listen to them perfectly here in my room. And he's like, well, and I don't know, but I can't listen to them in my cell phone. I'm like, on your cell phone, right? And then you kind of explain to them, like, okay, your cell phone probably has one speaker. So you're basically listening to everything that's panned in the center louder than the sides. And then they go like, oh, okay. And then they go to the car and listen to it and it's perfect. Or some people say like, hey, I can't hear the bass. And it's like, you can't hear the bass? Where are you listening to? On my cell phone. Are you listening to, like, with headphones or through the cell phone speaker? No, through the cell phone speaker. And then you go like, dude, that speaker cannot reproduce those frequencies. So you're not going to be able to hear the bass of your song or any song. At least wear some headphones or go to your car or, you know, use your home stereo or something.
That's a frustrating thing, I have to admit. There's a level of understanding of audio or just music in general that I think a lot of us just, we take for granted. We assume that the client feels the same way we do or addresses things the same way we do. And it's a new world. I mean, with devices that don't reproduce low end like laptops and cell phones, et cetera, it's a whole lot to navigate. It's a whole level of education that we have to participate in that I don't think, you know, maybe the challenges were a lot different when we were younger and not in this business. But drives me nuts.
Before, people used to listen to stuff in their car, like either in their car or at their home stereo, because there were no cell phones that were able to reproduce music.
And people had invested in bigger speakers and...
Yeah, and they were usually better than the ones you buy today.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky thing. I have to admit, I do check mixes on my cell phone with the Audio Movers plugin. I'll just stream it out and pop it on and listen for a bit and go, oh, there's some things I'm learning here, but there's no low end, but it's still fine.
Yeah, but I mean, if you at least get the kind of like mid-highs clear enough, it will translate pretty good to the cell phone speaker. I mean, respecting the frequency range of the speaker, of course, but at least you'll be able to understand what the singer is singing or listen to the hi-hat or cymbals without cringing.
Yeah, without it taking your head off.
Yeah, because, yeah, they can get pretty harsh.
It's like a sword.
Yes.
A well-sharpened sword or knife. Yeah, we definitely have those challenges of the day of most people are listening on headphones.
Yep.
So, yeah, we're almost out of time. I did want to ask you, and if this is a sensitive area for you, we don't have to go into it, but you have a kid from a previous marriage.
Yeah.
Are they still in Panama or are they with you here in the U.S.?
No, they're here with me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And is there a lot of going back and forth to Panama?
No, actually, my son's mother, she lives in California.
Oh.
Yeah, so he's with her right now. So he's spending some time with his mom. And I have my daughter with me and my wife. So it's all good.
So you know where I'm going with this. The work-life balance thing. You've got a lot on your plate because you're recent to the country. You're somewhat established now. You've got kind of a foundation going with the studio in Brooklyn. But what's the work-life balance like at this moment?
Luckily, my wife is very easygoing in that matter. When she met me, I was already deep into long days. So she's basically used to it. But anyways, I always try to make some time for her and for my daughter. Right now, for example, my studio, my room is in Brooklyn, but my wife, she's living at my mother's house in Massachusetts.
Oh.
Yeah. So I go back and forth between Brooklyn and Massachusetts at the moment.
Okay. And how are you doing? Are you taking the train or are you driving?
I usually just take a bus or something.
Okay. So Brooklyn, and then where in Massachusetts? In Salem?
Salem, yeah.
Okay, Brooklyn, I'm just looking it up. Distance to Salem.
It's 200 miles.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
That's 233.8 miles to be exact. That's a bit of a haul. So,
yeah, well, I mean, it's going to get better since we moved into a new country. It's like starting from scratch again, basically. Mm-hmm. So we're both trying to be as patient as we can because living in Salem is very much more affordable than Brooklyn, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I'm just being able to afford the studio and a room where I sleep in. Because, I mean, since I have a daughter, I wouldn't want to share an apartment. And apartments there are kind of very expensive for me at the moment. So right now, at the moment, I can't afford to like have an apartment in Brooklyn plus the studio. So I'm just working myself up again.
Okay. Allow me to play devil's advocate and ask you some questions about that in your decision-making about like, why did you feel the need that, so you're based in Salem, your wife and your daughter are currently in Salem, your mom's in Salem. Is it necessary for you to be in Brooklyn to work? Can you not set up shop in Salem and still get the same amount of work?
The thing about being in Brooklyn is that you are surrounded by musicians all over.
Okay.
So it's way easier to get work, like way, way easier. And since I've only been there for almost a year, it's still going to take time for me to know enough people that want to work with me to make a steady income stream to actually afford an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But it will happen soon. I mean, again, before the virus thing, everything was going just perfect. Like, let's say if nothing happened with the virus, probably at the end of this year, I could be affording an apartment.
Okay.
So everything was going perfectly. It's just that, well, now we have to wait a little bit more and that's it. Like I'm telling you, I'm starting over again. It doesn't matter if I have my Grammys or whatever. Now I am in another country where I don't know anybody and nobody knows me either.
Well, now they're going to know you.
Thank you very much, man. So yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of time and a little bit of sacrifice. And sometimes, you know, you get desperate and you're like, oh man, I want to be with my family, of course. But then you think in the long run, if you make the sacrifice now, then you won't have to be sacrificing yourself as much in the future.
Yeah. Do you travel a lot? I mean, how often do you go back and forth between Salem and Brooklyn?
Maybe every 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, I spend 2 or 3 weeks in Brooklyn and then I go and spend a week in Salem and then I go back. But yeah, I mean, right now, well, since everything got really messed up in New York, I went to Massachusetts and I was working from basically my bedroom, using a lot of the in-ears to mix because the bedroom is not very proper for mixing. And now I'm here in Rochester working with this band. And business hasn't stopped. So yes, I could probably just go to Massachusetts and forget about New York in the sense of the being in the music mecca.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important because there are so many musicians there and so many people that I want to know. Because they're either my heroes from my whole life, be it an engineer or a musician. And there are so many studios there that, you know, you only see them in magazines or whatever. And now you're there in that same city and you could probably book a session in there and record. I know this is very much like a little kid talking, like making my dreams come through and everything. But if you put yourself in another country, where you can only see people either on TV or YouTube or just listening to them on a podcast, but you know that you're never going to be able to meet them in person. And suddenly you are in the same city as them, then why not just give it a try?
Right. Well, it sounds like you're working hard and you have a plan here. And I wish you the best of luck. And at some point we'll meet in person when all this clears up and we find ourselves at a trade show together, I'm sure.
Yeah. Definitely.
Final question.
Yes.
Where does the name Nacho come from?
Nacho. Okay. That would be the diminutive of Ignacio. Ignacio, I think it's Italian. It's basically if you get the last syllables, Nacio, and you put it like Nacho.
I got it.
So that's where it comes from.
Awesome. Nacho, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And wow, what an adventure. All the way from Panama to Brooklyn. Man, I wish you the best of luck. I will be following you from here on out for sure.
Thank you very much, Matt. And thank you very much for inviting me to your podcast. Like, I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the time you've taken to speak with me. I know that you've got things to do and mixes to make or mixes to mix, but I appreciate it. Well, all right. Well, you take care.
You too.
Nacho Molino here on the Working Class Audio Podcast. Thanks so much for being here with me today. Want to thank everybody that helped out with the show, including Anne-Marie Plo on editing, Cliff Truesdale on the Working Class Audio theme music, and the magic voice of Mr. Chuck Smith there. Then connect on social media, connect on LinkedIn, follow us on Instagram, tell all your friends. And until next time, take care. Hey, I know many of you are aware of this, but for those of you that aren't aware, Working Class Audio sponsors the forum over at gearspace.com called Audio Life. And quite simply put, it's a place where audio professionals can go to talk with other audio professionals about things other than audio gear, including life hacks, work-life balance, health and hearing loss. You know, if you want to talk with other audio professionals who can identify with what your lifestyle is like, and how it relates to things going on in the world outside of audio, this is a great place to go and check out. So head on over to gearspace.com, check out Audio Life, many of the same topics that we discuss here on the show on gearspace.com. So check that out.